Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, all brought to you by Man Crates. Go to mancrates.com/martini for 5% off. We'll tell you a whole lot more about Man Crates a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, before we get to our martinis, it's worth pointing out that we got the breaking news we were all waiting for this morning. It wasn't necessarily good news, but right there at the daybreak in Punxsutawney, PA, we got this.
I see my royal shadow. 6 more weeks of winter to go.
Every time I hear that, I think of this from the actual movie Groundhog Day.
This is one time where television really fails to capture the true excitement of a large squirrel predicting the weather.
So, Jim, it is kind of exciting to watch that as long as you don't have to be out there in the frigid weather. The good news is it won't be, hopefully, 6 more weeks of waiting for the memo. That's supposed to come later today, maybe.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear. I believe the forecast is for 6 more weeks of frenzied and deeply partisan assessments of the memo. That's pretty much guaranteed going to happen. You know, every Groundhog Day, Greg, I reminded of my son was fairly young. My older son was maybe like 4 or 5, and I explained to him the tradition of Groundhog Day. And it struck him as the most ridiculous thing on earth, and I'm very proud of him for that assessment. And he said that if he sees his shadow at 6 more weeks of not believing, we're relying on a rodent for a weather forecast. So I was like, oh, my goodness, it's like looking at a little version of me.
Yeah, I think the magic wears off a little early. We had our girls watch the video of it today, and after they pulled the groundhog out of the fake tree stump, they're like, that's who's going to tell us if we have winter or not for the next few weeks. So, yeah, but it's still fun.
Sounds like the mayor's doing the talking, not really the groundhog. You know, Greg, whether or not he sees his shadow entirely comes down to whether it's sunny out or whether it's cloudy out. Which raises the question, what do we need the groundhog for if we already know what he's going to, you know, be able to see based on what the weather is that morning? So the weather on February 2nd determines how everything's going to be for the next 6 weeks?
I guess so. You mentioned the mayor of Punxsutawney, and whether he can speak to a groundhog is obviously up for severe debate. But he didn't murder the groundhog, which, of course, is the lasting legacy of Bill de Blasio.
Otherwise known as the notorious serial killer of groundhogs. Only one has been officially attributed. But, Greg, they've been finding dead groundhogs across this country for years now.
All right, let's move on to our actual martinis. Now, good martini, this is actually courtesy of The Week by way of The Intercept. The Democratic National Committee had a rough 2017 plagued by leadership troubles, internal squabbling, and unflattering reports. To top it off, the party ended the year dead broke, according to The Intercept's Ryan Grimm. The Democratic Party is carrying more than $6 million in debt, according to year-end filings, and has just $6.5 million in the bank. Do the math, and the party is working with just over $400,000 overall. Meanwhile, the Republicans are swimming in pools of money. The Republican National Committee had raised $132 million by the end of 2017, about twice as much as the DNC, and entered 2018 with almost $40 million to spare, with not a penny of debt. According to the Washington Post, the DNC says not to worry that they've raised more money in 2017 than they have in previous non-election years, and that they were operating at something of a disadvantage given the rebuilding job undertaken by first-year chairman Tom Perez. So they also claim their actual candidates are doing pretty well fundraising. But Jim, $40 million to nothing seems like a pretty wide margin here. Kudos mostly to Reince Priebus for cleaning up that mess over the past several years. And obviously, money equals message in a campaign, and so Republicans have the edge.
This is kind of strange news of bad news for the Democrats, because you look at other indicators, the polling numbers, a lot of particular Democratic candidates are doing fine in terms of fundraising in the early numbers we've seen so far this cycle. A lot of activist groups are saying that they've got more signups and more volunteers. And obviously we saw the Virginia elections, the New Jersey elections, a couple of special elections. Based on all that stuff, the Democrats could be doing well and should be doing well. But the Democratic National Committee, for some reason, just isn't. And in fact, the Democratic National Committee is doing terrible, considering all this other free-floating, you know, liberal activism and enthusiasm going on out there. I think this is a hangover from Debbie Downer, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and Donna Brazile, and all of the revelations about how the place was basically set up to ensure that Hillary Clinton won the primary, the argument that it is rigged, the argument that, you know, functionally it became a wholly owned subsidiary of the Hillary Clinton campaign once Hillary Clinton assumed all their debt. The best explanation to this is that, yeah, Democrats are really fired up in the era of Trump, and they really want to help their party win back the House and Senate, but they just don't trust the DNC anymore. Now, some of this also might be on Perez. My understanding is that he and Congressman Ellison don't get along particularly well. This was designed to be a unity ticket or unity group between the Clinton and Sanders sides of the party. It does not appear that everybody is getting warm and fuzzy and singing kumbaya. Now, is this going to be a huge factor in the midterms? No, but it'll be a fairly significant one. And if you're the RNC, you can take that $40 million and you can put it in pretty much wherever you need to. Like if you're worried about 40 seats, there's $1 million a seat, right? If you're worried about 80 seats, there's $500,000 a seat, right? I mean, you've got significant resources to put into these places. It'll not just be for advertising, but also be for get out the vote operations and things like that. And, you know, there's an argument to be said that the RNC's get out the vote operation in that last 72 to 48 hours in the election, you could argue it's what won the race for Trump. They targeted some particular districts in places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, places like that, and those were states Trump won by 1%. So he can make a difference in all this. This is not to say, you know, anything about the midterms is set in stone yet. But if you're the Democrats, you have good reason to worry, like, what the heck is going wrong with your DNC? And why can it not do any decent fundraising at a time when everybody else seems to be doing fine?
All right, let's move on to the bad martini now, Jim. And it was just yesterday we were talking about what good shape governors like Larry Hogan of Maryland was heading into the 2018 midterms. And that's certainly true. However, he is the subject of our bad martini today, but it's kind of a double-barreled bad martini, as we'll explain it as it goes along. Governor Hogan has written an op-ed piece that I found on Fox News. I'm sure it ran somewhere else as well, with the Democratic governor of North Carolina, and they are not happy with the Trump administration's plan to do offshore exploration and production eventually for oil and natural gas, which is something that we have talked about for a long time and conservatives certainly like for the most part. But here's what they write. As the Republican governor of Maryland and the Democratic governor of North Carolina, our job is to protect the families and businesses that call our states home. And as leaders, we expect that the concerns, priorities, and needs of our constituents are taken seriously when we communicate them to the president and his administration. That's why we're working across party lines to call on the Trump administration to take our states off the table in its plan to open most U.S. coastal waters to offshore drilling for oil and natural gas. Their explanation? In Maryland, home to the nation's largest estuary, the Chesapeake Bay, the seafood and tourism industries generate more than $18 billion annually, supporting 150,000 direct jobs that depend on healthy and productive waterways along a 1,400-mile coastline. A major oil spill like the one that took place in the Gulf of Mexico less than a decade ago would have devastating consequences for beachside hotels and restaurants, recreational and commercial fishing, and real estate in our states. There would also be dangerous health consequences for residents living in coastal communities from Ocean City, Maryland to Ocean City, North Carolina. And as you're grading over that, given the upgrades in technology and how rare something like Deepwater Horizon is, there is a foothold here that the Trump administration has let people get, which they point out in this letter, Jim, because Florida Governor Rick Scott also balked at this plan, had a call with Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary, and yada, yada, yada. Florida's off the table. It's not going to be part of the plan anymore, which means that gives a lot better standing, unfortunately, for these other states to claim the same thing. So what do you make of the Trump giving ground early on in this plan? And what do you make of Hogan suggesting that if it goes forward, the entire Maryland coastline is going to be awash in oil?
You know, Greg, the more I look at the issue of offshore drilling, the more I suspect you're never going to see a significant change in the policies of the United States. You will continue to have it in the Gulf Coast. I'd love to see it for the oil seepage that's happening off the West Coast. You know, Mother Nature is literally spitting oil at us, and we can't put anything down there to collect it. I imagine you might have some of the same natural seepage on the East Coast. But you look at the problem is that you have industries aligned along the coast, i.e. pretty beaches and fisheries, and all these people use the coast, and they're afraid of oil spills. And after something like Deepwater Horizon, it's kind of understandable why people would have that fear. So I'm enough of a federalist to say, as much as I want offshore oil drilling, I don't want to do it over the strong objections of people who live there, people who are afraid it's going to destroy their livelihood if, God forbid, there's an accident. So on the one hand, I kind of know in the back of my mind that it's very unlikely you're ever going to see many oil derricks off the Atlantic coast. Occasionally there's talk about it. There's, you know, questions about whether they should be exploring down there. I notice you don't see the same objections about giant wind turbines off Cape Cod and things like that. Although Ted Kennedy kept complaining, no, we can't do that because that's where I take my boat. My suspicion is that you're not going to see these changes because there are folks like, you know, Rick Scott who are going to say, look, even if they might like the concept of offshore oil drilling, they can't alienate all of the beach-based businesses in Florida for something like this, because each one of them knows if there's an oil spill, that's probably going to put them out of business if, you know, it takes a year to clean up the oil spill or something like that. So they gave Rick Scott the exception, except every other governor is going to want the exact same deal, and for pretty much the exact same reasons. You know, basically every state that's got a coastline has got some sort of most of the places you've got beaches, you've got tourism, you've got harbors, you've got people who like boating, you've got fishing. You know, these are all the livelihoods of these places. And unfortunately, they see oil derricks as a potential threat to that livelihood. Now, maybe someday they'll make, you know, such advances in safety technology that they'll be able to say with 100% certainty there won't be a situation like Deepwater Horizon again. People who've studied Deepwater Horizon say, look, this wasn't just one thing going wrong. This was like four or five. This was a cascading failures. But unfortunately, I think those images are very vivid in people's minds and they won't get it. The administration, whatever case it's got for this, it hurts its own case when it gives a special exemption to Rick Scott, because Rick Scott was one of the first people to endorse Trump when it was clear he was going to win the nomination last year.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, too. So domestic energy production is one of the best ways to have a consistently strong economy. So hopefully something can be worked out. But when you see the piling on like this, it's hard to believe that, given that and all the lawsuits that I'm sure are coming from the environmental groups, that anything substantial is going to be happening for quite a while. So, Jim, but if you are looking for something substantial, you have some advice for folks, I believe, particularly if they want to enjoy some things on the masculine side.
I do, Greg. Now, let's point out, I've heard the argument from Mrs. Campaign Spot, from a lot of my female friends, that men are hard to shop for. Comes Valentine's Day, oh, we get you roses, we get you chocolates, we get you something nice. But for men, you know, they're just not as easy to shop for. Well, a little while ago, went to mencrates.com, and I managed to get, as I told you earlier this week, Greg, the knife building kit. Yes, it's got the vise, it's got all the tools, it's got everything I do to make a knife, and I'll be running around like Crocodile Dundee soon, telling people, no, that's not a knife, that's a knife. And it's just an unbelievably cool thing. And this is what they have at mencrates.com. It's not, you know, if the guy's maybe chocolates aren't good for him, he's trying to watch his weight or something like that. Some guys like flowers, some guys don't like flowers. No, you can surprise him with a heart-shaped box of delicious beef jerky, the ultimate snackphrodisiac. Sorry, mancrates.com is the only place to find awesome gifts that guys will love. Now, this isn't some cologne sampler or a cheesy mug. Mancrates offers curated gift collections for every type of guy, from the sports fanatic to the home chef to the outdoorsman who wants to make his own knife, Greg.
Check out classics like the NFL barware crate and the whiskey appreciation crate. Whiskey needs appreciation. Or fresh takes on traditional Valentine's gifts like the jerky heart or the salami bouquet. Go to mancrates.com, pick the perfect gift, then wait for that magic moment. He'll fall head over heels when his gift arrives, and he gets to pry the wooden crate open with the included crowbar. They have thousands of five-star reviews, and every gift comes with a complete satisfaction guarantee. So right now, or at least when we're done on the podcast, go to mancrates.com/martini for 5% off. Mancrates does not offer a discount anywhere else. Get 5% off right now at mancrates.com/martini. One more time, mancrates.com/martini. Oh, Jim, this is a guy here in our crazy martini that we thought we were done with, and for the most part, we probably are, but Alan Grayson, most folks might remember, was a bombastic congressman from Florida on two separate occasions. I believe he first won in the 2008 wave when Obama was first elected, got beat in the Tea Party uprising of 2010, came back in a different district shortly after that, then got beat again as he ran for Senate, I believe, in 2016. So he's not in Congress anymore, but he's back in the news. Ala Pundit at Hot Air starts his story this way. Ah, Alan Grayson, a man so far to the left and so stupidly provocative in his partisanship that he was once described by Anthony Weiner. Anthony Weiner! As one fry short of a Happy Meal. A man so ethically clouded that Harry Reid told him to his face at a progressive caucus meeting, "I want you to lose." He's also a man who was accused by his ex-wife of multiple instances of domestic violence over 20 years. And then the Hot Air links to the video of a Politico reporter trying to ask Grayson about those allegations. They ended up bumping into one another. And here's the confrontation and the conversation between Alan Grayson and the reporter.
Do you seriously think that this is the proper way to conduct an interview?
You showed up to a Politico event, and the Politico reporter is asking you a question.
My mistake, okay? Now people know, going forward, that simply showing up to a public event means that you come and hassle me.
You're
and get in my
Congress.
Face.
You're a public official.
That gives you the right to push me?
You pushed me, sir.
You pushed me.
No, I was standing there, and you pushed me.
No, I'm sorry. You pushed me.
Well, that's very mature. But for those who might not remember Alan Grayson on policy, here's what he said the Republican health care plan was back when Obamacare was being debated.
If you get sick, America, the Republican health care plan is this. Die quickly. That's right. The Republicans want you to die quickly if you get sick.
Well, he sounds like a fine fellow. PolitiFact made news yesterday with this tweet. Big news. Former Florida U.S. Reps David Jolly and Alan Grayson have agreed to serve as reader advocates for PolitiFact. They'll be critiquing our work and publishing on PolitiFact.com. Read why we're doing this and let us know what you think. Then everyone, I mean everyone, even the Daily Kos was like, what are you doing? And so PolitiFact changed course. We sought out a Democrat and Republican to critique our work in order to try and improve the trust and credibility in fact-checking in PolitiFact. It has become clear our choice of Alan Grayson did not meet that threshold to many. Jim, I guess it's good that they listened to the criticism, but at some point, just about everybody who makes decisions at PolitiFact thought, you know, why don't we hire Alan Grayson to tell us what's true and what's not? Pants on fire.
And you know, you can't shove him to put those pants out of put the pants out of fire, Greg. You know, don't shove Alan Grayson. He doesn't like that. I suppose we should give PolitiFact a smidgen of credit, both for not picking him after the outcry and for recognizing that it would be a good idea to get a representative of the two parties or the two sides, the two ideologies, and decide, well, what do you think of our fact checking? Are we being even handed in it? Are we being balanced? There are a bunch of times. I think there was the time that the most famous one that just stands out to me as an example of why I just don't trust these organizations, or at least I have to read through carefully and I don't trust them to get it right every time, was, you know, Mitt Romney had said something like, this is the smallest the Navy has been in such and such years. And, you know, the argument from PolitiFact was like, yes, it's technically true, but today's ships are more powerful and they have longer ranges. They go for all the other explanations, but their assessment of it, you know, like usually you could say, okay, technically true, but needs more context or something like that. Fine. They said pants on fire for something that was true. Right. And this is what, like, I look at that and say, okay, you've got some guy who is frothing at the mouth, loves Obama and hates Romney. And they just wanted to call Romney a liar over that, even though he said something that's actually true. In the case of Grayson, I mean, come on, like, how does he make the list? Never mind end up being your first pick, right? I mean, I tried going through my head, like, who do I trust? Who would I say, okay, I think this person's fair-minded. William Galston is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal on the left side of the aisle. I think I talked to him for a book years ago. You know, smart guy. Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense, former CIA director, Bill Clinton's chief of staff. He's a left-of-center guy. He's a Democrat, but I think he's a pretty straight shooter. Anne Marie Slaughter worked under Hillary Clinton at the State Department. Has been, I think, a pretty straight shooter, willing to criticize her own side when she feels it's valid, and, you know, kind of a, you know, somebody I trust to play referee. Those folks are out there. You just got to look for them. And the idea that PolitiFact for a moment thought Alan Grayson was the right guy, kind of baffling and unnerving. You just kind of look at them and say, okay, if you don't have the judgment to recognize that, I don't think I want to trust your judgment on any of your so-called fact checking.
Yeah, that's the conclusion I come to. I mean, their reputation, as you explained, was in tatters already. I remember one time they said when President Trump blamed Chuck Schumer for sponsoring the Visa lottery right when the terrorism attack happened in Manhattan. And PolitiFact somehow, even though that was true, found the way to make that mostly false. So
very big on the, okay, technically true, but it's not fair, which is like, we can have that argument, or we can argue whether it's relevant or a, okay, but your job isn't to say, your job is not like fair check or something like that, right? Your job is not, you know, is there other context check.org or something like that. You know, the whole thing is, you're supposed to be, you know, just checking the facts. Is what they're saying accurate? And if it's not accurate, you know, call it that way. If it is accurate, call it that way, regardless of whether you like it or not. And that's that, you know, the nagging sense that their partisan preferences are affecting their judgment here. Unlike us, Greg.
Speaking of not fair, Jim, all of America has to watch the Patriots in the Super Bowl. I'm sure there are a few states up in the Northeast that are really excited about that again. I know you're really excited about the Eagles being there as well, given your roots in New Jersey and not cheering for the Eagles. Nonetheless, these teams will be meeting in Super Bowl 52 in Minneapolis on Sunday. The Patriots are a slight favorite. I see now that the Eagles have been battling the flu much of the week. So I'm not sure how Belichick arranged that, but I'm sure he did. I'll be cheering for the Eagles, but I just assume that the Patriots will win by less than a touchdown sometime in the last couple minutes.
That seems like a pretty accurate prediction to me, Greg. I'd love to be proven wrong. I hope to be proven wrong. As people may recall, last year I decided to try to sabotage the Patriots in the most devastating way possible. No, not properly inflating the footballs. No, I was just going to root for them. And wait for my bad luck and bad karma to affect them. And Greg, for the first half of that game, I was convinced I had power over space and time because the Patriots fell behind so far. But they managed to come back and win it. I'll be honest, though. I mean, growing up as a Jets fan, I'm kind of Eagles neutral. But it's worth knowing one other little anecdote about this. Last fall, my brother got married to a lovely young woman. We're welcoming her into the party, except her family is all Giants fans. So, you know, it's an interfaith marriage, Greg. That was the best man. My brother asked me to give a toast. And I do. And, you know, all kinds of wonderful stories about the two of them. But I point out that there's this really big, you know, elephant in the room that people need to address. It's, you know, how are you going to raise the kids? And of course, everyone starts chuckling. And I said, because they currently live in the Philadelphia area. And I know that like half the room is going to hate me for all the Giants jokes that I tell. I told them anyway, Greg. I'm not, you know. Giants were like, what, 0-8 at that point or something? It was like a 1-8 or something like that. Of course I had to rub it in. But I pointed out that there's no way I could let my brother and my sister-in-law raise their children as Eagles fans because I don't want my nieces and nephews to boo Santa Claus. For those who don't recall, the Philadelphia Eagles did boo Santa Claus, cheered Michael Irvin's injury, and apparently have a rumor of throwing batteries and things like that. So rough reputation. But you know what, Philadelphia, if you guys manage to knock off the Patriots, for one day I will be cheering for the Eagles. So good luck, guys. Make it entertaining. And, you know, if nothing else, hopefully the commercials will be entertaining.
Yes, exactly. Well, Jim, enjoy the commercials, if not the game. Talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And a reminder to go to mancrates.com/martini and get 5% off your next Man Crate. mancrates.com/martini. And tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.